Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP Monthly Training Series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Hello and welcome to today's podcast. We're excited to have Lisa Finke of Finke Law LLC in Gillette today, and she will be presenting the first part of a two-part series focusing on the representation of parents in Wyoming juvenile court proceedings. Ms. Finke authored Representing Parents in Abuse and Neglect Proceedings, an advocacy and training guide for Wyoming practitioners, published by the Children's Justice Project in 2016. And this two-part series focuses on materials in that handbook. The presentation today will provide information to assist attorneys practicing child welfare law and highlights information contained within the following handbook chapters: Representing Parents in Abuse and Neglect Cases, The Role of Counsel, Child Development and the Effects of Abuse and Neglect, The Wyoming Juvenile Court Process, Establishing the Attorney-Client Relationship, Pre-Adjudication Advocacy, Adjudicatory Advocacy, Post-Adjudication Advocacy, Federal Abuse and Neglect Laws, Special Issues in Abuse and Neglect Proceedings, and Related Proceedings. If you have any questions, please log in to the chat function, and we'll save some time at the end to field those questions. And with that, we will turn the presentation over to Lisa.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening today. As stated, today is one of a two-part series on representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. Part two will air on March 8th, and I hope that you all come back to listen to the second part. I'm excited to be here today and talk about a subject that I'm pretty passionate about, representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. When I was getting ready for this presentation, I was a little worried that since we're doing this presentation in the middle of winter, I would wake up on the morning of the presentation and be sick or lose my voice or something terrible like that and not be able to do this presentation. So I had toyed with the idea of pre-recording my presentation in this case. Well, I never got a chance to get around to recording my presentation, so that didn't happen. And then yesterday, I woke up with a horrible sore throat, and my legal assistant called in sick with a terrible head cold, and I panicked and thought, oh no, I'm not going to be able to do my presentation. So last night, I decided to record my presentation just in case I woke up sick today. Well, the good news for me is I wasn't sick when I woke up this morning, and the good news for you is that by recording my presentation last night, I realized how horribly boring it was. And that it was not a good presentation to give. I only get 2 hours to talk with you about what I think is a really important subject, and I don't think that it would have been quality time for me to bore you to death. So I modified my presentation a little bit. Over the past couple of years, the Children's Justice Project has put presentations on around the state about representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. These presentations are part of an initiative to educate counsel for parents and to distribute the CJP Handbook on Representing Parents in Abuse and Neglect Proceedings. You can find a link to that handbook on the CJP website. When I go out around the state to do those presentations, I put on a 3.5-hour presentation, and I've only ever made it all the way through my presentation once. There's just too much information out there that needs to be discussed, and the people who have attended those presentations have asked some really good questions, and we've had some really productive conversations. Those presentations have been designed to be beneficial to everyone, from new practitioners to those attorneys who can recall the days of DPAS. So when it came to these blog talks, my initial plan was to try and shorten and condense that larger presentation down to a two-hour presentation. In trying to do so, it was just too much information, and it ended up being a really fast-paced and boring presentation. So for the two presentations that I'm going to give on Blog Talk Radio, I want to step back and talk about the broader perspective of representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings and why this is such an important job. For those of you who would like any training or information on more basic or technical aspects of abuse and neglect proceedings, I'm more than willing to provide you with some resources on that or discuss those matters with you. You can call me at 307-686-4122, and I will gladly figure out what I can do to help you. Just leave a message with my assistant, Whitney, who is unfortunately out sick again today, so don't call today. So I am a total geek, and I love superheroes, and I'm going to start out by talking about superheroes. Over the years, I've gone to numerous trainings and presentations on child welfare all around the country. And if you go to a conference on child welfare, at some point in time, you're probably going to hear someone talk about social workers or counselors or prosecutors or other mental health providers, all those quote-unquote good guys in the system as being superheroes. But what you will never hear is anyone describing the parents as the superheroes. That's because in order to have a superhero, you have to have a villain. And unfortunately, when it comes to child welfare, if you have to make somebody the villain, the person who gets made the villain is the parent. Child welfare cases exist because someone, in the majority of cases the parent, has harmed the child in some manner. And there are very few people on this planet that are okay with kids being hurt. So what happens? People get angry at the parents for harming the children. People judge the parents for harming the children. And people are really unforgiving to the parents and don't believe that the parents can be rehabilitated. So the parents become the villains in the narrative. The problem is that when it comes to child welfare cases, the law says that the goal of a child welfare case is to rehabilitate the parent and preserve or reunify the family. But even though that's what the law says, even though that's the statutory duty of everyone involved, sometimes in these cases, not everyone is on board with that plan, and not everyone is on board with reunification. And that's why the role of parents' attorneys in these matters is so critical. In child welfare proceedings, the law mandates that certain entities and agencies are involved, that they are part of the team. The only member of that team required to advocate for the parent and the parent alone is you as counsel for the parent. So in a case where the deck is really stacked against the parent, your role is critical in making sure everyone complies with their duties under the law, that your client's rights are protected, that your client understands what's going on, and that your client is given a fair chance at rehabilitation. Now, as often happens in presentations like these, we end up talking about the extremes, the really bad cases. As you represent parents in abuse and neglect proceedings, you're going to have cases where the team likes your clients, where there aren't any major issues, where things go really, really smoothly. Not every case is some disaster waiting to happen. But what happens is that we as professionals are pretty capable of handling the easy cases. It's the challenging cases that cause us stress and anxiety, cause us to question what we're doing, and really challenge us to step up to the plate and do our jobs to the best of our ability. And so that's why in training sessions, the majority of the time we end up talking about those extreme cases. So in keeping with my superhero theme, I want to talk about superheroes for a minute. I'm a fan of the Marvel Avengers series, and so I'm going to geek out here a little bit and talk about those particular superheroes. pulling four superheroes from the Marvel Universe. Let's talk about Iron Man, the Hulk, Black Widow, and Ant-Man. And I apologize if you're not a superhero fan. This might be completely something you don't want to hear about, but for me it works to explain what we're trying to do in child welfare cases. So Iron Man, the Hulk, Black Widow, and Ant-Man are part of the Avengers. They're part of a team of superheroes. They routinely go out and save the world. Everyone admires them. Everyone wants to be like them. They are superheroes. Nobody thinks that they aren't worthy of what they do. In child welfare, everybody wants to be the superhero. But what happens is that if you take most superheroes, including the four I mentioned, and if you look into their backstory, into their history, you find out that most superheroes start out as a villain of some sort. They have to go through a transformative process to become a superhero. Iron Man was a narcissistic weapons dealer who was responsible for the death of millions. The Hulk had anger management problems and hurt everyone in his way before he learned how to control his anger. Black Widow was an assassin before she changed her ways. And Ant-Man? Well, Ant-Man was a convicted felon who lost custody of his child. And at the end of their stories, these individuals become heroes. When we talk about child welfare cases in the context of a superhero narrative, we're missing a golden opportunity if we don't realize that these proceedings are an opportunity to turn villains into superheroes of their own lives. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take parents who have made mistakes, who have issues, who have struggles, and turn them into superheroes in their own lives. And that is what we do as attorneys for these parents. We help these parents become the heroes in their own story. We help them address the issues that made people think that they were a villain and hopefully turn their lives around to become the superhero of their own story. So I'm going to steal a line from Disney's Hercules, and in these presentations, we're going to talk about how you as a parent's attorney can take your client from zero to hero in the minds of the opposing parties and the agencies we work with. And we're going to do that by talking about the ABCs of representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. So we'll begin with the letter A. A stands for advocate. The most important role you can serve as counsel for your client is to be their advocate. Advocacy is an art, not a science, and every attorney has to develop their own style in representing clients. Advocacy is how you approach a case and how you try to convince others that your client's position should be what happens. Your role as an advocate is to always put your client's wishes and desires first, but to do so in a manner that's not going to be harmful to your client. An example of this would be a situation in which your client has been ordered by the court not to consume alcohol, but your client is adamant that they should be allowed to drink because they're not an alcoholic. As an attorney, you have to find that fine line of advocating for your client without harming your client's overall position in the case. So you have to find a way to make that request to the court without convincing people that your client is an alcoholic because they won't give up alcohol or that they're an addict who's using alcohol to replace drugs. It's a very fine line, and we'll come back to that example in a few minutes. The advocacy role goes beyond just stating what your client wants. Advocacy is also about making your client feel like someone is on their side. I think one of the things that you'll discover as you represent parents is that when you go into court or an MDT and you advocate for your client, even if you lose the argument, the client will be very appreciative in most cases that you went in there and fought for them. I can't count the number of times that I've had a client tell me that that particular time was the first time that they felt like anyone in their life ever went in and fought for them. Sometimes that knowing that someone is on their side is the turning point for a parent to head in the right direction and start making choices that are good for their life and good for their children. In child welfare proceedings, the focus is so much on the child's well-being that sometimes the parents start to feel like the whole world is against them. Your role as counsel is to be there for your client so that they know that they have someone on their side. Sometimes all it takes is someone saying, I know you can do this, to put anyone on the path to becoming a hero in their own life, especially parents who are involved in these proceedings. I do want to note one important ethical obligation in regards to representing parents. As an attorney, you are obligated to advocate for your client's interests regardless of your personal beliefs. In many cases, you may be required to advocate for something that you don't necessarily think is the right thing, such as, for example, returning a child to the home when you disagree with what your client has done. You may also have to defend clients who have done some things that you believe are inappropriate or wrong. Under the rules of professional conduct for attorneys, your appointment to represent that client does not amount to an endorsement of the client's behavior, but it does amount to an ethical obligation to advocate to the best of your abilities for your client within the bounds of the rules of professional conduct. Next up in the alphabet, we have the letter B. B stands for boundaries. As a parent's attorney, you should do everything you can to help your client address the situations and issues that brought them to juvenile court. However, when you're appointed to represent a parent in a juvenile case, you're only appointed in the juvenile case. It's important that you make the boundary very clear with your client. Many of your clients will have more than one legal proceeding that they're working on. They could have a criminal case, a custody case, a workers' compensation case, you name it. Make sure your client doesn't misunderstand what your role is and what case you represent them in. If your client asks you to help them with something related to one of these other cases, direct them to their attorney in that matter. It is helpful if you communicate with your client's other attorneys, because that communication can help set the boundaries and can help in the sharing of information and representation. Beyond the actual representation of the client, it's important to set personal boundaries with your clients as well. Some of the parents you represent may not know what the meaning of the word boundary is. And if they're walking into your office at all hours of the day demanding to be seen or asking you all sorts of questions about your personal life, you can probably safely assume that they're doing that with everyone else they work with as well. Helping your client understand the roles that professionals play in their life and what their boundaries should be is going to help your client succeed. Explain to your client when it is and isn't appropriate to discuss their case, what they should and shouldn't be discussing with specific people. Beyond the juvenile case and your representation in the juvenile case, this is a valuable life skill that some parents need to learn, and it's going to help them immensely, and it's also going to save you a lot of grief when you're shopping at Walmart and you keep running into clients. Next is C, which stands for communication. The number one complaint that parents have about representation in abuse and neglect proceedings is that they can't get a hold of their attorney or that their attorney never communicates with them. Of course, if you were to talk to the majority of parents' attorneys, they would tell you that their number one complaint about their clients is that the clients never get a hold of them or that they can't locate their client to communicate with them. Communication can be very easy or very, very difficult in an attorney-client relationship. I have clients that call like clockwork at the same time every week to tell me what's going on in their case, and then I have clients that disappear for months at a time, change their phone number 6 or 7 times without telling me, and completely forget that I'm even their attorney, even though I'm sending them a dozen letters on a routine basis. Communication is very dependent on the particular client. As a parent's attorney, you should be prepared for clients who contact you once in a blue moon to report that they have great communication with you, and for clients that call 6 times in the span of an hour to complain that you never return their calls. Regardless of whatever the situation with your client is, communication is a key to successful representation. You need to actively make efforts to communicate with your client and ensure that they're complying with court orders and case plans. You also need to make sure they understand what is going on, what their obligations are, and what the consequences of not meeting those obligations are. My advice is to try and communicate with your clients by both verbal and written communication. B Being able to speak personally with your clients helps you explain things in greater detail and reminds the client that you haven't forgotten about them and that you're there to help them. But the written communication allows the client to go back and review information as needed. So next up is the letter D. D stands for diligence. In a lot of attorney-client relationships, the attorney represents the client through trial and then withdraws from the case. The representation only resumes when the client has another legal issue they need help with. This is not the case in abuse and neglect proceedings. Trial is in reality only the beginning of the representation. If there's an adjudication in your client's case, they're going to be required to continue to work with DFS for an undetermined amount of time. If they check out of the case at adjudication, or if you check out of the case at adjudication as their counsel, the odds are pretty high that the matter is not going to end in your client's favor or that it's going to drag on forever with no end in sight. As a parent's attorney, you can help your client move through the court process by being diligent about monitoring your client's progress, ensuring that unnecessary requirements aren't being placed on your client, and making sure DFS is meeting their obligations to your client as well. This requires you to keep your eye on the ball, so to speak, and to continually monitor what's going on in the case, what your client is doing, and your client's progress. The letter E stands for empathize. This can be a hard one for some attorneys, but it's actually a factor that can make a big difference in how your client's case proceeds. Empathize is different from sympathize. You don't have to endorse or justify the behavior that led your client to juvenile court. The definition of empathy is the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, and experience of another, of either the past or present, without having the feelings, thoughts, and experience fully communicated in an objectively explicit manner. So in short, to empathize with a client, you don't have to agree with your client's feelings or position, but you have to understand that they are allowed to have those feelings. Many times I'll have a client in my office going on and on and on about how frustrated they are with DFS for something that has been said or done, and many times I'm secretly thinking to myself in my head that DFS was probably right in doing what they did. But that doesn't mean I have to undermine my relationship with my client by saying that out loud and saying, you shouldn't feel this way, you don't have the right to feel this way. To be an effective advocate for my client, all I need to do is understand that for my client, this is probably a very frustrating experience. And believe me, the parents that you work with will be frustrated all of the time. And so by developing that ability to empathize with the clients, you can once again reinforce that you're on the client's side and that you're there to help them through this process. The letter F stands for focus. Oftentimes when I present on representing parents, I will use an image of an iceberg to describe juvenile court. Most of you have probably seen a picture of an iceberg floating in water. When you look at the profile of an iceberg, seeing what's above water and what's below water, only 10% of an iceberg will appear above the water, while the other 90% is below the water. For ships sailing out in the ocean, they have to be very careful because you can't see the majority of the ice. That particular danger is underwater where it can't be seen. I use this analogy and description to describe juvenile court because what often happens in juvenile court is that the case begins with one particular issue, but as the case progresses, other issues come to light and can overtake the case. The case starts with the 10% you can see, but ends up focusing on the other 90%. A good example of this is domestic violence cases. Many juvenile cases start out due to domestic violence in front of the children, but as the case progresses, it turns out that the real problem in the family system is drugs or alcohol, which led to and contributed to the domestic violence. Pretty soon, the case is snowballing, and things that are not important in the grand scheme of the case are becoming very, very important. and all of a sudden everybody wants to start pulling in every issue the family has and making that part of the case and part of the case plan. The most extreme example that I've probably ever heard is I once heard about a case where everyone wanted to close the case with the exception of one individual on the MDT team who thought that the case shouldn't be closed because the parents didn't have a kitchen table, and it was really important for the family to have a table to eat meals at. That's well beyond the scope of what an abuse and neglect case is about. To help your clients through this process, you need to keep things focused on what brought the family to the court system. Furthermore, you need to keep your client focused on what they need to be working on to improve their situation and get out of the juvenile court. If your client is not putting a priority on accomplishing their case plan goals, they're going to unnecessarily drag the case out. And ultimately, you want your client to focus on becoming a better parent to the children and to prevent the client from coming back to the system. The long-term goal should always be get the family out of juvenile court and make sure they don't come back again. As counsel for the parent, you can remind your client to stay focused on what really matters. G stands for guidance. As the attorney for a parent, you will be required to give guidance to your client on a continual basis. You will take on the role of counselor. This is an important role that you're going to play as you're representing parents in these matters. In abuse and neglect cases, a parent may not know what is in their best interest, or they may take a position that is contrary to their best interests. It's your role to advise the client of the consequences of their decision and to advise and influence the client to make the best decision possible. Turning back to my example of a parent who wants alcohol restrictions lifted, this is a good example of when you have to balance that role of advocate and counselor. As an advocate, you have to advocate for the client's wishes, but as a counselor, you need to advise the client that drinking is probably not in their best interest while they have an open juvenile case, and that requesting for those restrictions to be lifted is probably going to make people suspicious of them. In representing parents in abuse and neglect cases, the role of counselor can extend beyond just advising the client and giving guidance to the client within the abuse and neglect cases. Clients may seek advice from you that goes beyond the law and beyond their legal rights. Many clients that you represent are going to have some major life issues going on while they are working with DFS, and they're going to seek guidance from you on those issues. Potentially, they could seek guidance from you on financial matters, mental health issues, family problems, you name it. You need to figure out what you as an attorney are comfortable advising your client on and what needs to be referred to someone else. You may have a situation where you feel very comfortable giving someone parenting advice based on your experience as a parent, but if you've never had a child, that's something that you may not be comfortable with and may not be qualified to give. And always remember, boundaries are a two-way street. You've got to set your boundaries too. Ultimately, when it comes to the role of counsel, the number one most critical criteria in your attorney-client relationship is always going to be trust. Trust between the attorney and the client. You need to find a way to develop trust with your client, and you need to maintain that trust. When giving guidance to parents in these matters, they need to be able to rely on the guidance that you're giving them. Now, a lot of parents come into the juvenile court system very distrustful of the state, very distrustful of DFS, very distrustful of the court process. A large majority of them were probably abused and neglected children when they were younger as well. They may see you as part of a system that they don't trust because you're associated with the court in their mind, and they may not see you as their advocate or a support for them. I can't tell you the number of times I've had a client tell me, you guys did this, or you guys want me to do this. I have to remind my clients that I'm on their side, I'm not some secret operative of the Department of Family Services there to spy on them. I am their attorney and their attorney alone, and my job is to help them through this process. And that leads us to the letter H, which stands for help. Your job, quite simply, is to help your client. That's the best way to summarize your role in these proceedings. You need to help your client understand the juvenile court process. You need to be able to explain what each of the hearings means. You need to be able to explain what the law is. You need to be able to explain what their options are and why they're being required to do certain things. You need to understand their rights so that you can explain their rights to them. And you need to explain to them what they need to do to either keep their children or get their children back. I believe that when it comes to helping your client, you should subscribe to the mantra, if you can't help someone, at least don't hurt them. It is incredibly important for the rights of parents in abuse and neglect proceedings that they have quality representation. If you've been appointed to a case and you don't have the time to provide the parent with the level of help that they need within reasonable boundaries of what should be expected from an attorney, or you feel like the issues in the case are beyond your abilities or the amount of time that you have, you should consider asking the court to appoint another attorney for the parent. I firmly believe that a parent's attorney can have the biggest effect on the outcome of a case than any other party involved in the system. A parent attorney that, for whatever reason, can't provide the level of representation that's needed in a case can do far more harm to a client than, in some cases, I think, even not having an attorney. And ultimately, bad parental representation can cause a parent to feel like everyone, including you, is against them, that the system is rigged, and that they should just check out and give up. So we all want to help our clients. We all try to do the best job that we can, but we all have huge caseloads. And if you have a case where you just don't feel like you can give it your best effort, then please consider asking the court to appoint another attorney. So I stands for information. You should be providing your client with information about their case, and you should be making sure that DFS is sharing information with you and with your client. There's nothing worse than walking into an MDT, thinking your client is doing well, and then listening to the DFS worker go through a laundry list of violations that your client has had, and you have no clue that they've even been occurring. You also should be providing information to your clients about services and providers that are in your community that can assist them in achieving their case plan goals. If your client has authorized it, you should share critical information with providers to help your client achieve their goals. The number one thing here is pick up the phone and talk to people. Don't just wait for the next court hearing or the next MDT to get information about what's going on in the case. Call the caseworker. Call the guardian ad litem. Call the county attorney. Find out if they have any information that you need to know. Call the client. Ask them what's happening. Ask them to give you information. Check in with their counselors. Gather the information yourself so that you and your client don't get blindsided. There's no such thing as having too much information in a case. J stands for judge not, and this can be a hard one for any attorney in any case depending on the facts and circumstances. In some cases, particularly the really bad ones, everyone is going to automatically judge your client, and it's going to take a lot to move them off of that initial judgment. You're probably going to judge your client too. I'm not going to lie about that. We're human beings too. We make snap judgments about our clients. We end up representing people that we don't approve of their actions. We judge our clients. But as attorneys for our clients, we need to try not to judge our clients or not to let our judgments about our clients affect the quality of our representation. Even if you keep all of those negative thoughts you have about your client to yourself, sometimes subconsciously they can affect your representation. And so it's really hard, and it's something that you have to learn over the years as you represent parents, and take some time to develop the ability not to judge your clients, but to view them as what they are, human beings who have made mistakes, human beings who need help to move on with their lives, and people that need to earn some forgiveness and are deserving of forgiveness, and people that potentially could be the superhero of their own story. When everyone in the system is judging your client, the last thing that your client needs is for you to judge them too. Now, we all have those situations where we just have that one client that lies to us, that manipulates to us, that hides information from us. In situations like that, absolutely, if you need to, call your client to the carpet and let them know that that's not appropriate behavior. But don't do it in a judgmental manner that's going to deteriorate your attorney-client relationship. K stands for knowledge, and this is a huge one in representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. If you're going to represent parents in these proceedings, you need to know the law. Juvenile cases are governed not just by state statutes, but by federal statutes as well. You have various agencies involved that all have their own policies and procedures. There's case law and special rules of procedure. Juvenile law is very different from other areas of law. It's perhaps one of the broadest areas of law there is. As a practitioner in this area of law, you need to have information about all sorts of subjects. I believe that juvenile law actually requires an attorney to have one of the broadest bases of knowledge of any other area of law. I've seen attorneys come into abuse and neglect cases with no experience in these cases, with no understanding of these cases, and they try to treat them like they're criminal cases because that's what the attorney has experience with, and all that ever ends up with is a very unhappy judge. If you're going to be taking these cases, if you're going to be representing parents in these matters, you need to understand the juvenile court process. You need to understand juvenile law, and you need to especially, I can't emphasize this enough, read the Child Protection Act. Know those statutes. Most attorneys in juvenile court on both sides of the aisle, prosecutors and parents' attorneys, are very unfamiliar with the statutes and the details that are in those statutes. There's a wealth of useful information in there for parents' attorneys. It outlines some very specific requirements that the state and DFS has to meet, and those are great defenses in defending your client in court. With abuse and neglect proceedings, you have to have this broad knowledge of the law, but you also need to be able to understand and have knowledge of non-legal subjects. Perhaps some of the most important subjects that you need to know about are mental health, substance abuse, and domestic violence. The majority of the clients that you work with are going to have some sort of issue that typically falls in those categories. Mental health is a huge one to know about because, number one, it certainly affects how your client is going to parent the children, but it also affects how your client is going to interact with others that they're involved with as part of the system, and it influences how you interact with your client as well. If you have a client with mental health needs, you're going to need to spend some time understanding their particular diagnosis, working with their provider to understand how to communicate with this client, how to share information, and how to get them through the case process. And there can be some mental health diagnoses out there that are very difficult to work with and that are going to make for a very difficult attorney-client relationship. And again, knowledge is power. There's no such thing as too much information. The more you know about your client's diagnosis, the easier it's going to be for you to interact with your client. Substance abuse is another big area of non-law that parents' attorneys should be familiar with. A lot of the cases that you handle will have some substance abuse-related issues. Your client's going to be required to get a substance abuse evaluation. Potentially, they could be ordered to participate in a wide variety of treatments, and you need to understand what that is, what the requirement on the client is, what their options are, what facilities are available in your community and the state for your client to get the treatment that they need, and how the substance abuse has affected your client. The third non-law area that you see a lot of is domestic violence. Domestic violence is an area where people think that they know a lot about it based off of what they've heard, but the more in-depth you get into it, the more you learn about domestic violence and how domestic violence affects the children and how hard it can be to work with clients that are involved in a violent relationship. Most communities around the state have some sort of domestic violence agency that can be a good resource for information on this. There's also a lot of information online to help you understand the dynamics of domestic violence and how that's going to play out in representing parents. Domestic violence also has, as research is now showing, a really profound effect on the children. And so that kind of leads into the next non-legal area that it's important you have some knowledge about, and that's child development and child welfare in general. As an attorney in these cases representing parents, you're going to have at least a basic working knowledge of child development. When children should be reaching certain milestones, when a child is considered behind, any developmental issues that children may have. It's important that you have information about this particular area because in a lot of cases, if a child is developmentally behind, someone somewhere in the process is going to try and attribute that to the actions of your client. So to be able to know what is and what isn't developmentally appropriate, what could cause a child to be behind developmentally, those are going to be important tools in arguing on behalf of your client. The next letter in the alphabet is L, and that stands for listen. This is actually something that most attorneys think they're good at, but in reality, the majority of us are not that good at it. A client comes in, they start telling us about their situation, they start telling us about their case, we've read the discovery, we've talked with people, we know what's going on, and without really listening to what the client is trying to tell us, we give our response and our thoughts and our position and our plan for how we're going to handle things without really listening to what the client is going to tell us. This is another one where a lot of clients make a lot of complaints about parents' attorneys saying, I don't feel like my attorney listened to me. So if you really want to be a good attorney for parents in these proceedings, you need to take the time to listen to your client and listen to what your client is telling you. And believe me, they are going to tell you things that have absolutely nothing to do with the case, and that you are going to wonder why in the world they felt like sharing with you. But they're sharing it with you because they trust you, they want to build that attorney-client relationship, and quite frankly, they need someone to listen to them. Now, of course, we are not mental health providers. We're not there to provide mental health counseling to our clients. If that's what our client needs, then we should help facilitate that and find some resources for them. But sometimes, parents in these proceedings just need an opportunity to vent, to talk about their position, to talk about their concerns. You are that person. That is your role. And the more you listen to your client, the more you're going to understand your client and the better attorney that you're going to be for your client. I've had clients come into the office and tell me that they want me to go to an MDT or go to court and request that something happens, and my gut reaction is, that's ridiculous. Why would we want that to happen? Why would we request for that to happen? But then as we talk it out and I listen to what my client wants, why they're requesting this, where they're coming from, as I talk with my client, by the end of the time we're done talking and after I've listened to my client explain their position, they've convinced me that it's a really good position and it's something that we should go to court and advocate for because they have really good reasons for requesting what they want to request. Listening to your client also encompasses letting them tell their story about what happened and why the juvenile case started. I know sometimes as attorneys, especially when our caseload is really high, we read the discovery, we ask our client, is the discovery correct? And we move on without ever letting the client explain to us their side of the story, their version of what happened. And there's some very valuable information that you can pick up about the client, their relationship with the children, the family systems, from listening to the client talk about the family, can help you identify areas where your client has a need that you can help with, or your client has a strength that people have overlooked that you can go to DFS and advocate for. This is my client's strength. Let's work from this strength. So it's really important that you've listened to your client. M stands for mediate. As an attorney in juvenile cases, you serve as a mediator for your client as well. Now, some attorneys, when they represent parents, they want to go to court, they want to fight everything out, they want to do it in front of the judge. That is a perfectly acceptable means of representation in some cases. It's all factual dependent. It all depends on the case. It all depends on the situation. But one of the most powerful tools you have as a parent's attorney is to mediate on behalf of your client, to work as the go-between between your client and DFS to smooth things over, to make sure that everything is going well, to make sure that your DFS caseworker and your client are going to be able to work together to accomplish the goals of the case plan. You also will sometimes be put in the situation of mediating between the parents. Oftentimes, you will have to consult with counsel for the other parent to work on issues that are going on between the parent and get them to the point where they can co-parent the children. Working with parties, trying to work out disagreements between them, trying to smooth things over and make things go smoothly for your client can really speed up the process of the juvenile case. And I see by looking at the time here that we're nearing the end of the presentation. I want to leave some time for questions if there are any. So I'll conclude my presentation at this point we'll be back on March 8th to finish out this presentation. I thank you for taking the time to listen today. I hope it's been helpful and did not particularly bore you to death. But I will turn now to see if we have any questions.
Hi, thank you. No, not boring at all. I found it really interesting. Just one question, going back all the way to the beginning of the alphabet with advocates, and making the client feel like you were on their side when perhaps they've never felt like that from anyone before this. And you said that it was more of an art than a science, but based on your experience, do you have any suggestions or tips or tricks of how to build that relationship to make them feel that the attorney is on their side?
The first tip that I always give out when it comes to advocacy is a fairly simple one that everyone can do, and that is the first time that you're making a court appearance with your client in court, whatever hearing that may be, if you're there before your client, don't let your client walk down the hallway and see you sitting around and joking with the other parties. That's something that can immediately turn a client to thinking that you're some sort of state agent or working with DFS and working with the state against the parent. Don't let them see you joking around and sharing stories and whatnot with the other parties until you have had the opportunity to sit down and explain to them that you know what, we're a small community. These are the professionals that I work with. I see them on a regular basis. We spend hours together every day. We know each other pretty well. We're friends. But just because we're friends, that doesn't mean I work for them. That doesn't mean I'm against you. It just means that this is someone that I spend some time with. It's not going to affect how I handle your case. And so if you can get that conversation in with your client before they see you, you know, sitting around and chit-chatting with the other parties, that goes a long way to building that relationship. The other thing is it really goes back to listening, giving your client the time to sit down and listen to them and talk to them, and making sure, especially on the front end of the case, that you're communicating with them, you're talking with them about your case, that you understand where they're coming from and what their position is. And the more time that you can put into that relationship at the front end of the case, the more your client is going to view you as an advocate and feel like you're on their side. The other tip that I have is one that some attorneys are not comfortable with, because you can look pretty ridiculous in front of the judge sometimes. But if your client has some sort of request that you know the court's going to rule against, you know you don't want to make the argument, if you go into court and make the argument anyway, it shows your client that you're willing to take what their feelings and thoughts are into consideration and ask for that in front of the judge. And the judges are very understanding. They know where we're coming from. They know our role in the proceedings. And for the most part, they listen to the argument, and they know that you're making the argument on behalf of your client. And actually going through with that argument and making that argument to the judge instead of just saying, I'm not making that argument, can go a long way to building that relationship as well.
Thank you. Those are great tips to keep in mind. And if there's any other questions, you can save it for next week for part two of this presentation. As Lisa mentioned, next month, March 8th, which is a Thursday at noon, we'll have part two of the parent representation overview. And with that, I guess we will close our presentation and talk to you next month. Thank you.